you that? Is that working?
1, 2, 3. Oh, there it is. There it is. Good. Well, that obviously doesn't come up any further. Thank you. Is that all right? That's feeding back. All right. It's okay. Good. Now for my next act. Well, welcome tonight. Good to see you. We're running a series in the last couple of weeks on... is that ringing back? It's feeding back for me. Is there anything we can do about that? Sorry? I should get back. How's that? Further up here? On the stage. I don't like being on the stage. Feel so far away. Is that better? Still ringing a bit? No? Okay, well, good. Welcome anyway. Welcome to Rock Garden. This is our, third session? And moving back hasn't really helped stuff. We're still ringing. So what do I do? Outside, perhaps? Through here? That'd be good. Yes, further back. Further back. I don't know. Gain or something? 1, 2, 3. Should I sing? Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree, and he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. Or you'd like something, what? Every valley shall be exalted. No, you don't like that one? Oh, well, okay. Off the stage, oh, goodness. She loves me, yeah. Oh, well. We got the sound sorted out yet? Is that okay? That'll do, will it? Great, okay. I can still hear it, but that's all right. So this is our third week. We've been looking at the impact of Christianity on the modern world. And I just want to preface this again by a remark I made 2 weeks ago, and that is, I'm not trying to tell the whole story, because the point of these lectures is really to give the other side of a story that you've probably heard a lot about already. And I imagine that many of you, having gone to university or high school, if you've gone and watched movies, you'll often get the impression that Christians are usually the worst kinds of people, responsible for all kinds of oppression. And it's true, unfortunately, that people who call themselves Christians have done some pretty awful things in history. Right? Maybe I have some news for you. Christians aren't perfect. But you probably discovered that when you looked in the mirror this morning. So, but what we're trying to do in these sessions is to help you realise, in fact, that even with the mistakes that Christians have made, I think you can make a very strong case that there probably hasn't been anything that comes close to the story of Jesus for actually civilising the world we live in. Right, so the first week we talked about Christianity in the first century world, and last week we talked about the Christian origins of science. And I suggested to you, I'm not alone in this, it's a bit of a debate, but there are a number of scholars who would argue that it's impossible to understand modern science, not just discovery or invention, but modern science as a philosophical framework. It's almost impossible to explain that apart from the belief in the Christian God. Now, if you want to follow that through a bit more, I recommend to you one of the books that was up on the screen, the book that was on the right when you first came in. It's a book by Rodney Stark, who's probably one of the foremost social theorists or sociologists in North America today. And he wrote a book called The Glory of God. And his chapter on the rise of science and Christianity is really worth reading, I have to tell you. It's also, when he was doing that research, it's what converted him from atheism to becoming a Christian. So he began the project as an atheist, and as he worked through and began to realise the impact that monotheism, particularly Christian monotheism, had on the world, he eventually himself became a Christian. Now, tonight, what I'd like to do is, if we've got the sound working, give me a few seconds to try and get this right. Make sure everything's queued up and ready to go. Yeah, okay, good. This is a clip from the film Amistad that you might have seen. Anyone seen Amistad when it was out some time ago? Good. Well, see if you can remember this scene. Is that working? And let's hope everything operates as it should. Work. Thank you. Not going to react to this. I'll try that one. Oop. Didn't want that. Okay. I have to press a button. probably much easier.
Here we go. Siamo a pie. Tatuare ha che duello non gaia ma ti è pe che il lenga chi leggo
scene. Just before he goes back into court, that was the judge you saw praying, and he had to make a decision about which way the case would go. But one of the problems with that film, given all the good things it has to say, is it kind of gives the impression that the real champions of anti-slavery were in fact the humanist thinkers. And at the very end you'll see an ex-American president stand up and give this long speech about human rights, etc., etc. And then on the other hand, there is a chap in the film who actually is a historical figure, namely Lewis Tappan, who is one of the most profound and tireless anti-slavery workers in American history. And he's portrayed as somewhat indifferent to the suffering of these people. The other Christians in the film, somewhat ineffective. Unfortunately, this view is not that uncommon. According to the Council for Secular Humanism, the official position of the clergy was approval and support of slave trading, despite the horrendous suffering it produced. Slavery was a close companion of Christianity and was not thought to conflict with Christian doctrines. You can find that on a website this year. In 1990, a scholar by the name of Forrest Wood published a book called The Arrogance of Faith. And in it he claimed, Christianity has been fundamentally racist in its theology, organization and practice. English North Americans embraced slavery because they were Christians, not in spite of it. Well, I'm going to argue tonight that in fact the very opposite is true. Anti-slavery doctrine began to emerge very soon after the fall of Rome and led by the Middle Ages to the end of slavery in all but the fringes of Europe. When slavery was re-established in the New World, it was over strenuous papal opposition, and its abolition was initiated and accomplished by Christian activists. In fact, I want to suggest that if there's anything Christianity has done in terms of world history, the abolition of slavery certainly has to be one of the most important and significant things we've been involved in. Unfortunately, these days, political correctness tends to obscure the fact that the only significant opposition to slavery and moves for its abolition, come from the Christian West, from nowhere else in human civilization. Christianity has been and continues to be the best hope of slaves in human history, which only makes these more revisionist attempts, I think, all the more extraordinary and perverse. Now, a bit of background. Thanks for the hum. You going to deal with that, are you? Something happened? Great, your presence just did it. Wow. Come and stand here. This is terrific. The fact is, every great civilization, whether in Mesopotamia or China or places in between, including the North Americas, engaged in slavery, though it really took Greece and Rome to turn their societies into the first true slave civilizations. No Greek person ever seriously questioned slavery. Plato had slaves in his Ideal Republic. Aristotle, in his Politics, held that slavery was actually good for everybody concerned, since some people were born to be masters and other people were born to be mastered. In Rome, slaves equaled the number of freedmen, about 1 in 5. There was actually a move in the Senate once to get all the slaves to wear special clothing so they could identify them, but as soon as they found out how many slaves there were in the city, they scotched that immediately, lest the slaves see how many they were and then respond by rioting or something. Slaves were used for everything. If you're a pretty boy, you'd be used for homosexual entertainment. If you're an attractive girl, a brothel. Slaves were used for administration, for labour, etc., and buyers became expert in choosing the kind of slave they wanted that would fit their needs. Now think about that for a minute. Just look around the room, and in the first century, a third of you would be slaves. And of that third, if any of you happened to be good-looking, you'd become the sexual plaything of whomever. And no one batted an eyelid about it. That was just the way the world was. All right, now, if you find that a shocking thought, well, you've got Christianity to thank for that. Interestingly, people like Edward Gibbon, who wrote A History of the Roman Empire, and Friedrich Engels, one of the great Marxists of history, regarded slavery as the necessary price to be paid for the glories of Greece and Rome. When I was at school learning about Greek and Roman history, slavery never came up. I think it's probably different now. It's probably safe to say there would never have been the grandeur of Greece and Rome if it not had been done on the backs of slaves. Roman military victories flooded markets like those at Delos and Capusa that were capable of holding 20,000 slaves a day, and frequently they were running at full capacity. Small family farms had been largely overtaken by these slave-run plantations where slaves numbered in the thousands, most of them working in chains. Don't forget that most of the slaves were captured enemy soldiers, so they didn't want to give them too much freedom. They worked in chains during the day and were locked in underground prisons at night. They were cared for as long as they were productive, but once old or infirm, they were left to their own devices to perish. Cato, advised against allowing slaves women, because if they have women, they have children, and both women and children are too expensive to keep. Much better let the slave die and then buy a new one. After all, there were lots more where they came from. It's not unlikely that nearly every household held slaves, even if they couldn't afford them. A sign of abject poverty was not being able to afford more than two slaves. Many senators in Rome had more than 1,000, including cripples that they bought especially to entertain their guests. Think about that. People with physical disabilities being purchased purely for the entertainment of visitors at dinner parties. And no one thought twice about it. How'd you like that? Someone thinks you look a bit odd, and they buy you and parade you in front of others just for the humour you give them. Such was the glory of Rome. In Roman law, slave had neither legitimate marriage nor regular paternity. Neither was there any impediment to the most bizarre sexual practices, and there are records of slave women being used for the kinds of things that you'd just be amazed at. In fact, if you were a female slave, you had no sexual rights whatsoever. The master was free to do with you what he will, whether it was he himself or his friends or whatever happened to take his fancy. The most horrendous service that slaves faced was in the mines. Athens had more than 30,000 slaves working in its silver mines, and Rome had hundreds of thousands, and they consumed lives at an appalling rate. They were kept in chains, worked under the lash day and night without respite or indulgence until they collapsed from exhaustion or illness to die in torment. As one Roman historian remarked, their misery is so great that death is welcomed more than life. According to Mary Gordon, the growth of the Roman Empire was undergirded by human suffering, which is simply unimaginable in degree or extent. And no Roman really cared. There was always more where they came from. So what changed things? Well, partly, it's the Jewish heritage of Christianity. First of all, the Jewish Torah was much more tolerant and lenient towards slaves, required masters to be more merciful. And partly because Christians did not despise labour. In the Roman world, those who worked, anybody here got a job, were regarded as the dregs of the city. Rather different today. Christianity had a very different sentiment and would have nothing to do with people who paraded their leisured and idle curiosity. In fact, a Christian teaching document called the Didache required every Christian to have an occupation. Lazy, non-active, self-indulgent lifestyles, not accepted if you're a Christian. You had to be working at something. In fact, Paul says, if you don't labour, you don't eat. Now, one of the great things about the early Christian movement, as I've mentioned before, is that Christians really took no account of one's social status. In fact, some of the early bishops of Rome had been slaves. Pius in the 2nd century, Callistus in the 3rd century. In fact, so complete was the abolition of social status that on occasion, Christian teachers had to rebuke slaves to stop them from showing contempt for their masters. You shouldn't show contempt for anybody. But such was the freedom they were enjoying and experiencing that they felt they could do this. Christians restored marriage and family to slaves. Masters were expected to respect a slave's marriage and to legitimize it. Once a slave woman was married, her status was as sacrosanct as if she was a princess. And Christian slave owners, Christian slave masters were told to observe those kinds of regulations. Pagan slave masters might at a push allow their servants or their slaves to buy their own freedom, provided they were able to pay the market price. Christian slave owners were encouraged as an act of almsgiving to free their slaves without any payment whatsoever. And many Christians did that for all the slaves they owned. Now that's a considerable financial loss, but that's what they did. It was only Christians who released all their slaves during their own lifetime. And many of them lost their personal fortunes in doing so. Now that's got something to say to us, right? I'm not sure exactly how much I let my Christianity touch my financial well-being. But there are records of very wealthy Romans who became Christians releasing thousands of slaves. In fact, in one case, so many slaves were released that the biographer couldn't even number how many there were. Now, with the barbarian invasions, things began to change. Under Christian emperors, there had been quite a series of advancements made in terms of providing the slaves' rights and requiring masters to observe certain kinds of duties, and that continued in the East. The code of Theodosius II, Christian emperor, really began to push this trend more effectively. But with the coming of the barbarians, things began to change rapidly for the worse, unfortunately. It greatly increased the number of slaves, and they were subjected to far worse conditions than they'd experienced even under Rome. Now, what was the church's response? The church responded in three ways. Documents from the 5th to the 7th century, so this is the early Middle Ages, are full of accounts of bishops, priests, monks, lay people buying back slaves taken by the barbarians and returning them to their own homes. So one of the first things they did was put their money together and begin to buy back slaves from the invaders who captured them. The church councils began to legislate in favour of slaves, and Christians were urged to set an example through their kindness. Of particular interest is Spain. During the 6th and 7th centuries, Spanish authorities began to make particular moves to really lighten the burden on slaves. In fact, they were the first to suppress slave trafficking outside their borders. Now, what they mean by that is you couldn't sell somebody from Spain to an area outside of Spain. That was fairly common in the ancient world, but the Spanish began to reduce that. Furthermore, they began to follow this process of moving from slavery to serfdom. Now, most of you, if you watch the movies, think that to be a serf is a terrible thing. But in fact, it's actually a major advance on slavery. Because if you were a serf, you did have some rights. You weren't simply somebody's chattel. You could marry who you pleased, your family was your own, and you had some kind of discretion in terms of what you did with your time. Now, none of that applied as a slave. Now, as the church began to get land given to it, as wealthy people became Christians, they found themselves actually becoming slave owners unintentionally. They couldn't just let these people go because they had lots of land, so what they did was arrange a special kind of serf arrangement. Sounds like something happens at the beach, doesn't it? They actually reduced the amount of money that a serf had to pay. Under a normal landlord, a serf would have to pay 50%, on church lands only 30%. And when times were bad, often no rent at all. Now, you might think that people who lived in those days didn't have much of a diet, but there's a Cambridge professor who's argued, from the evidence he's been able to amass, that in England during this time, a peasant had a far better diet than the people living in the towns during the Industrial Revolution. But we don't often hear about that. Nevertheless, that is the case. That sounds like a Windows machine. Someone's Windows machine just do their thing? It's got a welcome sign up there. Thank you, Mr. Windows. Now, I don't want to suggest that during this time Christians are all sweetness and light. There were some popes who were not very effective. But the fact is that many, many Christians were working towards eradicating this evil from Europe. And not just in Europe. You happen to know, probably around about the 8th, 9th centuries, up into the 11th and 12th and beyond, Islam began to grow and began to have incursions into the West. And when they did, they often captured Christians and forced them into slavery. There's a Catholic group called the Mercedarians, otherwise known as the Society of Our Lady of Ransom. And between 1218 and 1632, they redeemed nearly 500,000 slaves from Islamic North Africa, even if it meant handing themselves over as substitutes. And many of them actually suffered horrendous martyrdoms because of this activity. In one year, in 1787, a Catholic group called the Trinitarians redeemed 900,000 slaves from Algiers and Tunis. Now, what about the New World? Well, once the New World was discovered, you had territories that were no longer seen by many people as lying under the control of the church. Often tough people were required to make those kinds of journeys and try to settle those new lands, and tough people often have pretty rough morality. So slavery began to break out again in force in the New World. But it needs to be understood that it was over the protests, the strenuous protests of papal authorities. In 1462, Pius II declared slavery to be a great crime. In 1537, Pope Paul III forbade the enslavement of the Indians and said no Indian was to be given in servitude to anybody. About a century later, Pope Innocent XI said the same thing about Africans. And it goes on and on and on. The problem was, of course, the Catholic Church didn't have as much power as it would have liked to. And you understand at that time, European princes and kings were trying to throw off the yoke of the church as they saw it. And so frequently were unable. The church was unable to get these requirements to stick. But they still spoke up. If you've watched The Mission, you'll know that Spanish Catholics refused to allow slavery to take part in to take place in their territories, even though Portugal, that had been far more influenced by the Enlightenment, had a much more easy attitude towards slavery. The fact is that where the Catholic Church had some influence, slaves were treated far more liberally in all kinds of ways. And I think it's pretty much a demonstrable historical fact that the Spanish treated their slaves the best and the English were the worst, actually. So just a little word here to us Protestants who like to think we're so much more wonderful than the Catholics. On issues like this, we don't always have a particularly good history. So if you grew up like I did, where the Catholics were almost like the beast with 666 in their forehead and that kind of thing, it comes as quite a salutary reminder to see at this point the Catholics actually being far more Christian in the way they treated people than many of our Protestant forebears. Now, North America. It's sometimes being claimed that there was no slavery in North America till the Europeans came. Well, that's actually not very true. Leyland Donald in 1997 wrote a book called Aboriginal Slavery on the Northwest Coast of America, and he really demonstrated the kinds of things that were going on. Slaves made up about a third of the population of villages in this part of the world. They were employed in subsistence tasks, and slave trading formed a major part of some tribes' economies. Slavery was universally regarded as shameful and degrading, but that still didn't stop them from enslaving about a third of their population. Slave status was hereditary. If you were born of a slave, you remained a slave. Manumission, that is, releasing slaves, was almost unheard of. Masters in North America, that is, First Nations masters, as in Rome, had complete control over their slaves and could kill them at will, which they often did when a slave became old or sick or simply rebellious. They were often used in ritual sacrifices and especially during the master's funeral. So if you've ever had this idea of the noble savage, that it's only the white people who do bad things, you've been watching too many Dances with Wolves movies, and you probably need to go back and do some history. In fact, even PBS, hardly a friend of Christianity, had to admit that it was the Catholic priests who regarded Indians as humans and treated them with equal dignity, even while not only European adventurers, but even their own Indian chiefs did not. So in both North and South America, it's a matter of sober historical fact that Indians were far better off in the care of missions than they were in the hands of the secular institutions of the Enlightenment. That's not to say they were perfect. These are not modern people. They're people of their day, and they would do things that would horrify us. But fair's fair. You've got to look at people in their cultural milieu. And if you take that seriously, then I think you can say that what was going on in the Catholic missions was far superior to what was going on anywhere else. In Africa, slavery continued unabated in Muslim-controlled countries. Now, part of the Islamic problem here is Muhammad himself owned slaves. And if your primary prophet is a slave owner, it's very difficult to find the spiritual, intellectual, and moral resources required to confront slavery, which is probably why Islam never really did. It may come as a surprise to some people to know that slave trading in the Islamic world had begun centuries before the discovery of the New World, with at least as many Africans and probably more being sold in Islamic slave markets as were ever sold in the American ones. Now, Islamic slavery was more consumer-oriented than it was labour-oriented. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, in Rome, labour-oriented meant you put your slaves in the fields or the mines and basically worked them to death. Consumer slavery has to do with slaves in the household. And for that reason, female slaves, especially attractive ones, were in much greater demand in Islamic markets than males were. Adult males and boys, and I'm sorry about this, but it just happens to be true, would have their penises removed, as well as other parts of their bodies, before they were sold into slavery. Now, Islamic law has a prohibition against this kind of defacing of the human body, so they would often forcibly require Coptic Christian doctors or Jewish doctors to perform the operations for them. This is in an age where there's no such thing as anesthetic, by the way. Every 4 years, Ottoman officials would tour every subordinate Christian district, find the most suitable Christian children who were then forcibly removed from their homes and raised as slaves in Muslim households. In 1535, when Charles V of Spain invaded Tunis, he released 20,000 Christian slaves. In 1571, at the Battle of Lepanto, 15,000 Christian galley slaves were released by Don Juan, though a far greater number probably perished in the ships that sunk during that battle. Now, when the Islamic world began to discover more of Africa, they took about 7 million Africans by 1600, with another 2 million in the next two centuries, and another 1.2 million around about 1900. Overall, 10 million. Now, those are the slaves who actually made it. Based on historical research, the number of slaves who perished was somewhere between 35 and 66% of those who set out, which means that the Islamic world has taken somewhere between 16 to 30 million black Africans and sold them into slavery. Now, I'm not here to attack anybody, right? This is not some kind of anti-Islamic agenda. But this is some historical data that you just need to know about. Now, it's often claimed that the Islamic world had far better respect for the way they treated slaves, and in some cases that's actually true. But there is an interesting question to ask. If you cross the border, the further you go south in the United States, you'll see increasing numbers of black people. Right? And why are they there? They're the descendants of black slaves. Given that this many black slaves went to the Near East, where are they today? Where are their descendants? Why do we not see many black people or people of Negro descent in that part of the world? And the answer is, as I've just explained, black males were mostly castrated, and infants having any kind of black ancestry were frequently exposed or killed at birth. Now, the end of Islamic slave trading was finally forced on them by the British, who embargoed their slave ships, and British and French colonists who intercepted countless Muslim trading caravans. And it was only in this last century, the 1900s, that Western pressure actually brought an end to official Islamic slave trading, though if you know something about the Sudan, it still goes on in enormous numbers. The fact is, with the coming of Europeans, yes, there were some horrible abuses by European business people, adventurers, but it was also the missionaries who often preceded European intervention or European investigation of these countries, exploration. They would often buy blacks out of slavery and establish freedom villages for those whom they redeemed. Now, just something to keep in mind here, the fact is both European slave traders and Islamic slave traders couldn't have carried out their business without the assistance of black slave traders. And the truth is that slavery had been known in Africa long before Islamic people or European people turned up. It was just a part of the culture there. And so the black slavers were just as happy to sell to the Europeans as they had been to other black slaves or other black tribes before the Europeans came. Now, a few words about the anti-slavery movement. I'm sure you've heard of David Hume. He's one of the great heroes of the Enlightenment. If you study philosophy or the history of ideas, he's one of the great luminaries in Western thought, celebrated champion of reason and patron saint of the modern university. What did he think about blacks? He thought that black people were naturally inferior. And if a black person showed any kind of intelligence, he dismissed them as trained parrots. Thank you, David Hume. The great free thinker Voltaire, John Locke, who championed the inalienable rights of man, and even Charles Darwin and Thomas Jefferson held similar views. And can I suggest that it's actually these free thinkers being freed from the benighting influence of Christianity that enabled them to hold these views about people who weren't white, because you couldn't get away with it in the church, certainly not in the Catholic churches. So while Hume, Voltaire, Locke and others derided blacks, Wesley and Whitfield exhorted their followers to see blacks as fellow human beings and whose children were to be regarded as equal to their own. So in about the mid-1700s, there was a tiny group of Christians who formed the Anti-Slavery Society. It was just a small group, and they involved two kinds of people. There were some lawyers, really trained in legal affairs, and there were some philosophers. And they set themselves the task of changing the English intellectual climate. Now, folks, where are the Christian lawyers? Where are the Christian intellectuals who could set themselves the task of changing the way the Canadian world thinks? Where are they? This is how it began. A group of Christians who knew they needed to take on the legal system and they needed to change the way people think. Tragedy is, if you walk into most Christian bookstores today, you'll find resources for neither of these two exercises. And it's a tragedy. Can I suggest the reason why Christians don't have much impact on the world is because we don't know how to think, we don't know how to engage our culture. And for most of us, it's not about that anyway. It's about my comfortable life and my nice house, whatever, and not really getting involved too much. Now, I know it's tough when you're just on your own, but it'd be great to be able to encourage one another actually to get involved and start to think about these things. It was a very scary prospect. There were huge financial interests opposed to them. What were they going to do? Well, I'm going to read you a little story. And this will pretty much bring us to the end. I'll say a few things at the end about modern slavery and Christian involvement in this. But I want to read you a story about a guy called William Wilberforce. Wilberforce was the only son of a prosperous merchant. And while he was yet young, he won a seat to Parliament. In fact, only at the age of 21. A diminutive figure, he left a safe seat to contest the largest borough in all of England. And after a grueling campaign, all was in the balance as he mounted a table to address a bored and cold public who stood in the pouring rain to hear his election speech. His oratory won them over. As one observer commented, "I saw what seemed to be a mere shrimp mount upon the table, but as I listened, the shrimp grew into a whale." And so Wilberforce arrived in London. London at this time was one vast casino. I guess Vancouver's fast becoming something similar. Where fortunes were made and lost in a fog of claret. Gaming tables and duels of honour were the order of the day. Higher society thrived on romantic intrigue and adultery. No popular hostess ever invited husband and wife to the same party. That just wouldn't do. The poor, who were the fodder of the empire's emerging industrial mills, were crammed together in appalling conditions. Their children worked 18 hours a day in the mills for a mere pittance, while their parents spent what they brought home on cheap gin. Highwaymen were folk heroes, and a starving 12-year-old who had stolen a loaf of bread might be hanged on the same day as a celebrated criminal, all for the entertainment of immense crowds who came to watch. And underpinning all of this was slavery. This rancid trade in human flesh, whose victims were deemed nothing more than goods and chattels. Few raised their voices in protest. After all, the wealth of the nation depended on it. I mean, how are we going to get our freeways if we don't have these casinos? I mean, okay, some people are losing money, but come on. Freeways really matter, folks. Corruption was endemic in government, with few members of the House of Parliament thinking twice before accepting bribes. Planters and other gentlemen involved in the slave trade would buy whole boroughs at seats in Parliament for the enormous sum of £3,000 to £5,000. That's a huge amount of money. That's millions of dollars in our terms. Right, so interested slavers doing this to get their representatives into the House of Commons. The same attitude reigned in the House of Lords. The slavers' political influence grew until a large bloc controlled the vested interests. Was controlled by the vested interests of the slave trade. However, during a holiday on the continent, a rather flippant Wilberforce was challenged by an evangelical schoolmaster, Isaac Milner, who basically said to Wilberforce, "Let's be serious about life, and let's have a serious discussion about what it means to be a Christian." Wilberforce was stung by the challenge, and he agreed. So they took a trip around Europe and spent a few months of discussion and reading the New Testament, which, by the way, they read together in Greek. As a consequence of this journey, a radically changed and troubled Wilberforce returned to England. He sought the advice of John Newton, one-time slaver but now converted during a storm at sea, and author of Amazing Grace and an outspoken Anglican clergyman. Newton counseled Wilberforce to follow Christ but not to abandon public office, saying to him, "The Lord has raised you up for the good of his church and for the good of the nation." And so it was on a foggy Sunday morning that in 1787 Wilberforce found himself reflecting on what it meant to be a Christian. Surely it could not be merely a matter of being saved from sin. If Christianity was true and meaningful, it must go deeper than that. It must not only save, it must also serve. And his mind turned to the thousands of blacks in misery caught up in slavery. In his tiny cramped handwriting, and under the power of a mounting conviction, he wrote in his journal, "Almighty God has set before me two great objectives: the abolition of English morals." Gathering around himself a few faithful compatriots, one chap by the name of Grenville Sharp, a hook-nosed attorney with a razor-sharp mind, Zachary Macaulay, a quiet, patient researcher with an encyclopedic memory, who spent countless hours sifting through the evidence to build a damning indictment against slavery, and Thomas Clarkson, a red-headed clergyman with a passion for justice and righteousness. And this small band began the battle. It was a stirring start, but within a year, Wilberforce suddenly fell gravely ill, and his doctors confirmed he would be dead within 2 weeks. His opponents saw an opportunity to oust him from his seat and rid themselves of this troublesome pest. But Wilberforce recovered. Too unwell to return to Parliament, he prevailed on Pitt to introduce a bill to have abolition at least discussed. Although lacking Wilberforce's passion, Pitt saw the bill passed. Sorry about that. And the slavers, after all, saw no harm in having the matter discussed. However, things moved quickly. Some parliamentarians visited a slaver's ship and, horrified by what they saw, added fuel to the fire. Sensing a real threat, the vested interest rose up in opposition, denying all the charges and decrying the stories of cruelty as mere fabrications and myths. But Sir William Dolben moved a motion for a one-year experimental regulation of the number of slaves to be carried on board a ship. After heated exchanges, it was passed. Now, the success of this bill was a rude awakening for the slavers, who now realised just how serious a threat Wilberforce was mounting. When he returned to Parliament, they were spoiling for a fight. "How dare politicians mix politics with morals?" The Earl of Abingdon sniffed, "Humanity is a private feeling, not a public principle upon which to act." And Lord Melbourne, after whom the city I was born in was named, angrily agreed, "Things have come to a pretty pass when religion is allowed to invade public life." Heard that kind of talk, have you? Interesting, isn't it? Friends of slavers all, perhaps. hate your little whittling sneer, your pert and self-sufficient leer. Mischief to trade sits on your lip. Insects will gnaw the noblest ship. Go, Wilberforce, be gone for shame, thou dwarf with big resounding name. So how'd you like one of the great writers of England to pen this about you? But Wilberforce and his compatriots knew that a private faith that did not act in the face of oppression was no faith at all. And he continued with a passion. He wrote, "It is impossible for me not to feel both terrified and concerned at my own inadequacy to such a task. But I march forward with a firmer step and full assurance that my cause will bear me out." But he also acted with humility. He said, "I mean not to accuse anyone, but to take the shame of this dreadful thing upon myself. In common with the whole Parliament of Great Britain, I am guilty for having suffered this trade." We are all guilty. He's not being self-righteous. He's not accusing people. One thing that's not in here, but Wilberforce is actually known as the life of the party, and anybody who was having a party in London would make sure he was at the top of the list. So he wasn't some kind of, you know, stiff shirt, self-righteous. He was just lovely, lively guy, apparently. People enjoyed his company. He just happened to be anti-slavery, which they did not enjoy quite as much. After 2 years of hard work, he failed in his 1789 introduction of the bill. Undeterred, he and co-workers, spending up to 10 hours a day researching, were ready 2 years later, in 1791, to fill the House of Commons again with his thundering eloquence. "Never, never will we desist until we extinguish every trace of this bloody traffic," he declared in Parliament. The opposition was equally determined and reminded all as to the cost of such a move. Loss of jobs for 5,500 sailors, 160 ships, exports worth £800,000, and the demise of the West Indies worth at least £6 million. We're talking trillions of dollars in today's terms. The vote came up, but commerce clinked its purse and Wilberforce lost yet again. It was time to reorganise, this time with a more realistic appraisal of what lay ahead. Forming the Clapham community, they decided to take the issue to the people. Thousands of tracts were printed, petitions circulated, hundreds of public meetings addressed. A boycott of slave-grown sugar exceeded all expectations, gaining a following of 300,000 participants. In 1792, Wilberforce presented 519 petitions to Parliament, signed by thousands of British subjects. This time, many were moved, and even the slavers were unable to prevent the passage of the bill. But they did manage to get the word gradually inserted. They could relax, knowing that the bill could be postponed indefinitely. Things were looking bright for the abolitionists, but that year, the French Revolution turned sour, and the September massacres at the guillotine meant the death knell of any reform movement in England. Such movements were immediately denounced as Jacobean and linked to the radicals who had taken over in France. The tide turned swiftly, and aided by an ill-timed revolt by slaves in the West Indies, the move to abolish slavery abated. The House of Commons now flatly rejected Wilberforce's proposals, and he found himself lampooned in popular cartoons and ridiculed by his critics. Grim-faced and tired and weary with grief, frustrated after 4 years of ceaseless effort, Wilberforce returned home to his old oak desk and wondered if he should abandon his hopeless campaign. As he sat disconsolately flipping through his Bible, a letter fluttered from between its pages. Wilberforce stared at the shaky handwriting. The writer was dead. In fact, the letter was one of the last he had ever written. Wilberforce read it again. "My dear sir, unless the divine power has raised you up to be his Athanasius Contramundum, I see not how you can go through your glorious enterprise in opposing that execrable villainy, which is the scandal of religion, of England, and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them together stronger than God? Oh, my friend, be not weary in well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of His might. To live in American slavery, the vilest that was ever seen under the sun, shall vanish away before it. That he that has guided you from your youth up may continue to strengthen you in this and all things is the prayer of your affectionate servant, John Wesley. Strengthened to resolve, Wilberforce returned to the fray. For the next several years, he introduced his bill only to see it thrown out again and again. When in 1796, nearly 9 years after they had begun, after the fall of the radicals in France and a turn toward peace, public opinion began to swing again in their favour. Victory suddenly seemed within reach. But the third reading of the bill took place on the opening night of a long-awaited comedy. And a dozen supporters, convinced that the bill would pass easily, skipped Parliament to enjoy a night out. A grieving Wilberforce saw his bill defeated by just 4 votes. It would take another 12 years. Think of that. 4 votes, a night at the opera, and 12 more years of misery for people in slavery. Think about it. And so it went on. 1797, 1798, 1799, 1800, 1801, year after year without success. His efforts of over a decade being thwarted by illness, compromise, intrigue, and the war with France. Nevertheless, the long battle had welded Wilberforce and his compatriots into a tight-knit and efficient team. With 5 of them now members of Parliament, they had succeeded in forming a number of reform movements. The Society for the Education of Africans, the Society for the Bettering of the Condition of the Poor, the Society for the Relief of Debtors, which over a 5-year period obtained the release of 14,000 English people from debtors' prisons. They established prison reforms, hospitals for the blind, help for war widows and distressed sailors. Zachary Macaulay, at one time a wealthy man, gave away all he had and died penniless for the cause. Derided as the saints, they bore the name gladly, considering such a distinction a welcome reminder that their commitment was not to political popularity, but to biblical justice and righteousness. The abolitionists again prepared for their fight in Parliament in 1804. The climate had changed. Opposition scare tactics no longer worked. Public sentiment was increasingly swinging behind them. The bill was passed by the House of Commons 124-49. But in the House of Lords, where the slavers were better represented, the bill was adjourned. Defeated yet again. A despondent Wilberforce was further grieved by the loss of his friend Pitt, who died that next year. However, Pitt was succeeded as Prime Minister by William Grenville, a staunch supporter of Wilberforce. This time, they changed tactics and introduced the bill into the House of Lords first. A bitter and emotional 4-week battle ensued. But at 4 o'clock in the morning, on February the 4th, 1807, the House of Lords passed the bill. But there was still the House of Representatives, the House of Commons. Just under 3 weeks later, on February the 22nd, 1807, the second reading was held in the House of Commons. outside, a soft snow was falling. Inside, candles flickered on the cream walls of the long room, filled to capacity, but unusually quiet. Lord Horwick opened the debate in a nervous and disjointed speech that reflected the tension in the chambers. Then, slowly, one by one, members began to jump to their feet to decry the evils of the slave trade and to praise the men who had fought so long to end it. They hailed Wilberforce and the abolitionists. As the debate rose to a climax, Sir Samuel Romilly gave a passionate tribute to Wilberforce and his decades of labour, reflecting on the countless minions who would rise up and bless him. Stirred by Romilly's words, the entire house rose cheering and applauding. Wilberforce, realising that the long, great battle had at last been won, sat bent in his chair, his head in his hands, tears streaming down his face. 30 long years had passed after he first began his apparently hopeless struggle. The motion to abolish slavery was passed 283-16. It's a powerful story, isn't it? The battle wasn't over. There was a battle in the Americas yet to be fought. Once again, it was the Quakers who led the charge, followed later by Baptists, Presbyterians, Methodists. In fact, one of the judges who presided over the Salem witch trials, I don't know, perhaps as some kind of penance, wrote one of the first stirring indictments of slavery in North America. It's tragic, though, that many Southern Baptists, because they put their financial security ahead of justice, sided with slavery. But in the end, even though some of them were killed, it was the Christians who began to mount what might be the first mass mailing in history, organizing themselves, learning how to engage with the debate, understanding the issues, eventually began this ultimately irresistible move that would result in the overturning of slavery in North America. Well, what about today? You realise, of course, that the fight against slavery is not yet over. In this 21st century, it's estimated that there are still millions living in slavery or near slave conditions. Tens of thousands of children in Southeast Asia are involved in carpet weaving, working in quarries, and in the sex trade. Worst of all, the Sudan. Nearly 100,000 Christian black women, their men and husbands murdered, are raped, branded, and sold to Muslim masters. Between 1995 and the year 2000, Christian Solidarity International, imitating those early Roman Christians, had bought back nearly 21,000 of them. Still only a small proportion. This is our heritage, folks. Being Christian is not just about having a great worship time. It's not just about attending nice churches in the suburbs. It's about changing things. Now, some of you drink coffee. It might be time to begin to put the honest bean ahead of our taste buds, and only to drink coffee where there's a fair wage provided. And if it's not the greatest, well, who cares? What's more important? Chocolate industry. Initially begun by Quakers, actually, Cadbury's, Roundtree's, very concerned about the lines down which the chocolate came. Very concerned that the workers in the African fields received their due wages for what they grew. Sadly, their modern descendants are not so concerned about this. But there are people who are now producing fair trade chocolate, and it might be worth thinking about that. It's only a small sacrifice. But why not? Why not? As Paul says in Galatians, in Christ there's no longer Jew nor Gentile, male nor female, slave nor free. Wilberforce had it right. A Christianity that was only about being saved and not about serving was no Christianity at all. It's a wonderful heritage. It's changed the world. Something for us to live up to. Thank you very much.